The psychology of travel. The psychology of everything, in fact. Why do we travel? Are holidays good for our health? What are the social and psychological factors that drive us to move? A new book provides an eclectic introduction to the range of travel experiences we go through. It is the new book by Andrew Stevenson. Delighted to say that Andrew joins us live on the line. Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
Pleasure is all mine. Why do we have this need to travel, to go on holidays, even to commute?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm actually quite surprised that psychologists haven't put more effort into studying this before, but there really isn't a lot of research into the psychology of travel. I suppose most people associate travel with tourism. But of course, tourism is only one subset of travel, and people travel for work, sometimes reluctantly through migration. But about, I would say over half of the main motivations for travel are for pleasure or enjoyment or even self-improvement, of course.
It's interesting you say self-improvement, because before we did the interview, I was thinking why people travel. And as you said, most people say, oh, it's about holidays. And of course, the holiday is a relatively new invention after the Industrial Revolution, because before that, people did, in the Middle Ages, you didn't go on holiday. But what you did do, if you wanted to, you went on a pilgrimage or a crusade or something like that. So it was a spiritual move to travel, if you like.
That's a really interesting point, and of course you're right. Travel is a relatively new phenomenon. I should also point out that it's not a universal phenomenon either. I would say most of the travel, the outgoing journeys really are concentrated from a small number of nations, and there are plenty of people all over the world for whom travel isn't an option. And so we should remember, really, that it's not something that everybody does, and most US citizens don't even have passports. And of course, we've recently all been through a period where travel was quite suddenly an avenue that was cut off to us. And we're really just coming back into discovering the world again. But yes, you could say it's sort of culturally relative, but it's also temporally relative as well.
Because I remember everybody was saying, when I can go out my front door, I'm going to take that trip that I always promised myself.
That's right. And, we perhaps all have a bucket list of places we'd like to visit. But I think really over the last 12 months or so, many people have started to reevaluate travel in some ways. And, those walks in the park during the pandemic suddenly became our travel, didn't they? And many of us, myself included, discovered quite a lot of new places and new experiences that were on our doorstep that we didn't know about before the pandemic. So we can often have some of the similar sensations that we experience in exotic locations, actually in more local spaces as well. So it's about a frame of mind. It's not just about the number of miles we do, is it?
Yeah, but it's very interesting, isn't it? Because amongst certain people, travel is seen as, I mean, it does broaden the mind, but on a spiritual level, you can't get a spiritual experience unless you are sitting on top of a hill in Bali or something like that. It can't happen if you're in Barnsley rather than Bali, for example.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, I'm sure you're right to some extent, but I mean, if you think about, psychologists have looked at this concept of humanism and mindfulness. You may have come across that, a kind of Zen Buddhist approach to experiencing life can lead you to almost like a transcendental experience in very mundane settings. And conversely, I guess there are times when we find ourselves traveling in exotic locations, maybe climbing Everest and suddenly realizing that we're in a queue of hundreds of other people who've also decided to climb Everest on the same day. And so many of those popular destinations which promise a transcendental experience, sometimes it can be quite mundane experiences because everybody else has decided to do them at the same time. I suppose what I'm trying to say, Giles, is that the experience of travel depends as much on your inner karma and your inner state as it does to the actual location that you're at.
And also there's a thing about, if you like, can we call it cultural tourist appropriation or imperialism? Because there's something a little disturbing about going around the world to a very poor country, you know, with your with all your bangles and saying, oh, you know, look at, you know, look at this wonderful culture. I mean, there's that aspect as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, travel can sometimes be an experience in or an experience of sort of observing without really immersing yourself in the experience of travel. And some psychologists have suggested a kind of typology of travellers, if you like. In other words, travellers fall into different categories. There are those at one extreme who, yes, they might visit Mexico or Indonesia, but they do so within the bubble of the tourist industry. And that might mean never actually conversing with people who live locally in those places. And furthermore, not really contributing to the local economy. At the other end of the scale, there are those people who might categorise themselves more as travellers than tourists. And the motivations of a traveller might be more similar to an anthropologist, for example, who wants to immerse themselves and learn about a culture and maybe unshackle themselves from their own culture. I've got a lovely quote here from the novelist Paul Bowles, who's trying to explain the difference between a tourist and a traveller. And he says, "Whereas the tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveller belongs no more to one place than to the next, moving slowly over periods of years from one part of the earth to another." So, yes, you're right. When we travel, we have to make a decision, don't we, about how much we want to immerse ourselves or not.
Absolutely. It's not only about leisure travel, as I said before, and the commute. People commuting to work. Now, this is something, again, that didn't happen during the Industrial Revolution because you basically lived in the shadow of the factory. But now, over the past 100 years, we can say the commute, suburbia, has become a thing, and people are quite happy to travel for an hour, 2 hours in one direction to work and then come back the other direction. That's a 20th / 21st century concept, isn't it?
It is, and I'm often amazed when I hear stories of people and colleagues as well who spend perhaps 30% of their energies in a working day actually either in a car or on a train. And again, the pandemic has taught us to perhaps reevaluate some of the travel experience that's connected to work. And we've recently seen the emergence of the concept of the digital nomad, who is this kind of 21st century worker who may work in a more sort of pop-up environment and can go and work in internet cafes, as not so popular now as they used to be. But the whole idea that you can work in a place where the laptop is, you can work from home, you can work in a coffee shop. This is all, of course, related to trying to cut down on travel times. And maybe we're seeing an increasing awareness of the climate emergency and people realizing that there isn't really always a need to fly for 11 hours to go to a conference and deliver a PowerPoint presentation and then fly all the way home. Maybe that's a slight difference in perspective that we're starting to see now.
But perhaps one of the things there was, say, in the 50s and 60s, if you were a corporate executive, and it was generally male, I'm thinking you're sort of Mad Men, etc. Here, you were in the job for life because you didn't tend to change around, and therefore it was you had that mentality that you must get to the office. The office is where it happened, and business travel was a perk. And again, it's only with what's happened over the past couple of years that we've re-evaluated about the need to actually travel.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic has really brought into sharp focus some of the questions that were probably there anyway about whether the time we're sitting in our cars is productive time. I mean, I don't drive that much, but when I do it, I don't know about you, but I find it quite an exhausting experience. And rather than spending 8 hours at my desk, rather have a bit of a lie down after a long drive, to be honest. I find it quite stressful, but it's one of those things where I think we're getting better at trying to be more efficient in the way that we work. On the other hand, Giles, there's the other thing, of course. You mentioned the office. The office is a place to work, but it's also a place to meet with colleagues and socialise. And these long periods of working from home haven't been such good news for our mood swings and our what's sometimes called our mental health, obviously. So we have to strike a balance, really, I think, between travelling out of habit and using the office as a more of an interactive space where we don't just sit alone in a cubicle or a bubble and work for 8 hours.
You also discussed the concept of slow travel. Now, I'm familiar with slow food movement, which has been gaining ground for sort of 20 years now. But what's the slow travel, what's the concept of slow travel?
Well, the slow travel movement really began in the sort of 1950s and 1960s with a group of activists known as psychogeographers. Who are a sort of hybrid literary figures, part psychologists, part geographers, and part poets. And they were really very interested in the way that we consume environments and the way that we sometimes bypass them and don't take any notice of them as we move through them. And so one of their big ideas was to think about what is a journey or a holiday, for example. When does it start? Does it start when you arrive in your destination, or does it start when you begin your journey? And so for them, I would say that the idea of traveling to Spain from the UK on a train, those hours on the train would be as much part of the holiday experience as would those 6 or 7 days that you would spend in that particular place. And so it's the idea of sort of realizing that there is value in all experiences. And you mentioned, was it Barnsley before or Bradford?
Barnsley or Barley, take your pick.
Poor old Barnsley. But anyway, I'm sure Barnsley is a lovely place, and I would say that the site psychogeographers would argue that it's not a question of whether Barnsley is a nice place, but it's how you approach it. And if you're in the frame of mind to find interesting experiences and quiet places or maybe peaceful locations in those spaces, then each of these locations can be of equal value. So it's about, I suppose, a cliche, but it's about valuing the journey as much as a destination, because these days we spend so much time on the way to places as much as we do being in places. So we may as well try and value those moments of mobility.
And of course, if you look around on your journey, you can find unexpected treasures, can't you? Unexpected places, and you can make connections with fellow travellers, because, I mean, a lot of people just head to the airplane, head down, you know, open up the minibar and go for it. But if you're slow travelling, if you're taking a train across somewhere, you know, trains are great, buses, you know, coaches as well, you, if you want to, can interact with your fellow travellers, and that's how, you know, those exciting journeys and experiences happen.
It is, and I mean, one of the other, related to that, one of the other psychological topics that's relevant to this is the concept of memory. And of course, memory is a key topic in psychology, but it relates so closely to the way that we travel. And we're always talking about travel memories. And you might think back to a time when you've been traveling yourself, or you've been on holiday. What were some of the most memorable things that you did? Were they things that you knew you were going to do and that everybody else was doing at the same time? Or were they some of the quirky events and unexpected discoveries that you found on the way or on a walk between two places or something like that? And so what we tend to do is we try to remember selectively the experiences that we have of travel. And someone once said that travel is one of the best bits of our lives, and we often remember those by using photography and taking pictures and selfies and so on. They're a great sort of edited version of our experience, and it's one way in which we selectively remember the experiences that we're having now.
We're talking about travel as a commute or as a leisure activity, but of course some people have no choice in traveling. They are forced to move due to economic circumstances or war, migration. And for one reason or another, it's obviously a huge topic in the UK at the moment.
Yes, it is. And this is a sort of very distinct category of travel. And often in psychology, we've looked at the experience of what's sometimes known as acculturation, which is really refers to what happens when you move from one culture to another and the challenges that you face when that happens. And of course, acculturation can be voluntary or involuntary, but it's really about looking at whether or not one is able to adapt to the values and norms of another culture, and also whether that culture or destination is making an attempt to try to, reach out to people who are newly arrived. And the concept of arrival can either be very stressful or it can be something which provides a lot of opportunities. But one of the things that we often do to ease that transition is to try to develop networks within new destinations, and also to use memories of where we came from to try to think about similarities between where we came from and where we're going. And so there are lots of factors which can make that transition more difficult or easier. In fact, when we see people from different cultures interacting with each other, research has suggested that those interactions go much better when those interactions take place between people who are of equal status. And a lot of the problems with acculturation occur where one cultural group is perhaps economically much more prosperous than the other. And so it's about trying to reduce those differences as well in economic means.
It's an interesting, wasn't it, about migration and nostalgia for the old country. I'm thinking about obviously the east coast of the States and the Italian and the Irish populations who moved there but kept their identity. And then you look at, I mean, obviously we are Spain's largest English language station, and there are areas within Spain that are very much, especially for the British people, that you could almost say it's like the UK in the sun. But again, the nostalgia for the old country is perhaps only as a good, as those positive, or perhaps the tinge that it was better back then, etc.
Well, that's right. I mean, this takes us back to the relationship between memory and travel. And some researchers have talked about the difference between homesickness and nostalgia. And, one of the differences between them is that homesickness is often a feeling of sadness, which can be remedied when you revisit where you came from, sort of like a cultural top-up, if you like, to make you feel a bit better, whereas nostalgia, of course, is a yearning for something that can never, ever be revisited. It's almost a yearning for a lost situation. And so, historically, nostalgia was listed as a disorder in psychology, whereas now it's regarded as something which is almost poetic and wistful. But again, it's about, as you suggested, forming networks of people which enable you to discuss and memorialise and share memories of something which you might all remember but is in reality never going to be recovered. So, there's definitely a social value in experiencing nostalgia as a group rather than experiencing it in a solitary fashion. Because travel, Giles, really, it's a very much a social activity. And I've often heard people say that they've gone travelling on their own. And I mean, I defy anyone to go travelling on their own, because whenever you're travelling, you may not be with any of your friends, but you're going to be surrounded by hundreds of people. And the things you do and the choices you make are always going to be influenced by how many people are in this cafe. Is this beach empty? Why is nobody going into this particular part of the city? So the sort of social nature of travel is also something that's a key area of interest for psychologists of travel.
And also, I mean, travel can bring into sharp focus two other top topics. We talked about people going on holiday and going to the same places. They see a brand they're familiar with. It could be a coffee brand. It could be a beach club or a restaurant that's got, it's a multinational. And if you want to have a look at the effects of globalization, they're seeing that firsthand. And also climate change, because you know, people say, oh, well, this beach is a lot, you know, the weather has changed. We have more fires here, or more floods here, etc.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things you mentioned there. I mean, there is that thing about traveling. In terms of miles, technically, you may be traveling a long way, but there is that urge for some people to be very conservative in the way that they still go to McDonald's, or look for the Irish pubs, those types of things. I'm speaking here from a sort of British perspective. I can remember cycling in Malaysia once and went on what I thought was a very exotic trip, but I love Marmite, Giles, and I took two jars of Marmite with me on this cycling trip. And it was only after a couple of weeks when I realised that I was clinging on to my UK identity that I decided to relinquish the Marmite and embrace the local food a little bit more. So maybe that was a lesson for me.
Did you find a local version of Marmite is the next question, obviously.
I did find, I don't think it was a local Marmite, but I found a lovely sort of rice dish which is called idli, and having lentil dal for breakfast was a new experience for me, but I sort of got into the habit. Going on to your other point though, Giles, about climate change, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but the other thing that we should think about here is this phenomenon that's sometimes known as eco-anxiety. And of course, anxiety is a well-known sort of condition. It's a sort of when you worry about something, but you can't quite put your finger on what it is. But eco-anxiety is a sort of very understandable and justifiable worry about what's happening in the climate emergency. And the question is, does that change our travel habits? And I think quite a lot of recent research into this that suggests that people are starting to think about conservative travel a little bit more. What I mean by that is maybe just not giving up flying or not abandoning all multinational labels, but maybe just trying to think about reducing these habits or reducing the patterns of consumption a little bit. And it is related to anxiety, but it's not an anxiety which is irrational. It's a well-justified anxiety about the future of the planet.
So, what was the spark behind this one? What made you sort of decide to put this down on the page, as it were? What was the spark?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, my area of psychology is about culture, cultural diversity, and human and behaviour. But also in my own life, I really like travelling, I've been lucky enough to, you know, travel to a few different places, and I do research in Central America, and I'm a regular visitor to Guatemala. But the thing is that I had an opportunity, as we all did, for a year or 18 months, where we weren't able to do any traveling. And I just sat down and thought about what I was experiencing it as a non-traveller. There was a kind of lockdown on travel, and I started to think about it, and I realised that psychology, you mentioned the psychology of everything, and my book's part of the series that's called The Psychology of Everything. I was thinking, why isn't there a psychology of travel? Why hasn't anyone written about this? Because travel relates to so many psychological concepts like health, memory, migration, topics which are fairly mainstream in our subject, problem solving, all of these things. But there didn't seem to be a book about it. And I just found it to be an excellent opportunity, really. And the book's really, it's not really about my experiences. It's about the topics that we all know in psychology and how they relate to something that we so much love to do. And it's such a popular, habit, isn't it, traveling? When people talk about bucket lists, the thing that they want to do in the next 20 or 30 years, almost all of them relate to travel. And so it seemed like a good time to write the book.
The book is called The Psychology of Travel. It's part of the Psychology of Everything series. It's by Andrew Stevenson, who we've been speaking to today. Andrew, if people want to find you, ask you some more questions, are you online? Is there an online presence? Where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, and you can also find me through our Manchester Metropolitan University, which is my working home for now.
The book is called The Psychology of Travel. Andrew Stevenson, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Lovely to meet you.